Do you have friends or family there?
People had started arguing now, some calling for calm, others shouting across the room to each other for any new information they could dig up on their phones. Someone had a laptop out and was connecting it to Elk Cliff's Wi-Fi.
I don't think so, Ori said, but his head was swimming. He felt dizzy.
This is really bad, Max kept saying. This is really, really bad.
Ori tried to refute that, to be the strong, steady one who would keep them both anchored. But he couldn't find the words. The TV was back on the helicopter camera, hovering over Boston city limits. The body of the fallen shadowless man still in the street. This time, pixelated into an indiscernible mass. Ori couldn't tell for sure, but it looked like even in death his shadow hadn't returned. The thought sent a chill through him. The National Guard were still shoulder to shoulder, a wall across the road. They looked shaken, as if they were clinging to one another instead of forming a blockade. One was holding a black body bag in his hands, gun strapped back across his shoulders, but he was held by orders in the line, unable to go forward and lay it over the dead man, in case whatever was causing the forgetting was transmissible through the air. The soldiers suddenly tensed, and guns rose from their downward angle to point straight forward with agonizing dread. More shadowless were approaching. Some running, some screaming, some silent. This time the station didn't waste any time. The screen cut back to the anchor at the desk, who was scrambling through freshly scribbled papers and a blaring earpiece, trying not to listen for the sound of impending gunfire through the tiny speaker. Mid-speech, he stammered. A long, horrible pause. He closed his eyes involuntarily. Then he opened them and kept going. Ori glanced around the room and swallowed hard to try to calm himself down and looked back at the screen. Then he heard the anchor say something about Denver. He pulled Max closer, wrapped his arms around her, and squeezed with everything he had as the news cut to a reporter in Colorado. Someone had begun to sob. "Hey," he said as he crushed her into the hug. The shocked, rising hum of too many voices at once echoed off the stone walls of the ballroom. Shouts and ringtones blended into an eerie, doomed musical harmony. He wanted to say something comforting, to sound like he was there for her, to make it feel like it was all going to be okay soon. But the fear had numbed his mind. "Blue," he finally managed, no more than a whisper.
52.
She whispered back.
I can't really avoid it any longer, I guess. Not talking about it isn't going to change that it happened, so I might as well say something before I forget how it went. I don't know if I believe you yet, Ori. If recording things will really make a difference at all. But if it does... Well, I don't really know what are the most important things to get down on tape yet, so I figure I should probably just say everything I can think of. Including this. So, the day I lost my shadow. It was 2 weeks ago now. Which is a pretty long time for me to still remember as much as I do, judging by past cases. Everyone's different, though, they say. Heimojoshi started losing his memory so quickly. Just a few days in. But there were reports of some people in Mumbai who took a month to forget anything significant. I think the longest one I ever heard about before the electricity went out was about a month and a half. So hopefully I'm more toward that side of the average. These past 2 weeks have felt like a year, in some ways. To have a month and a half left before it all goes. It might feel like an eternity. This is strange, talking to myself and you like this. Especially since I'm not there with you anymore. I have a confession. I actually wasn't going to use the tape recorder, even though I promised you I would. But then I got out here, alone. And I just... It feels good to talk. It makes me feel real, still. I know I'm the one who left and that you'll never hear this, But before I start, I want to say, just in case. Ori, if you're listening to this, somehow, some way, it didn't hurt. So don't worry about that part, at least. I hardly felt it. There was nothing about that morning 2 weeks ago that seemed different. I'm sure you'd say the same. I looked normal, felt normal. We split a can of corn from our dwindling cupboard supply, and then you left to check the trap and then the city. I've racked my brain for anything. A sign, a twinge, a premonition. But there was nothing. After you left, I went into the kitchenette to do the counting for us. How many matches? How many shotgun shells? How many pills of found Tylenol, amoxicillin, doxycycline? I felt like a squirrel, counting how many nuts we'd managed to store in the hole in our tree to see if it was enough to last through the winter. You know this already. The kitchenette was my favorite room in the shelter. Because the window was so small and our floor was high enough up that a person couldn't see in from the ground, so the glass there could stay uncovered. At first you wanted to block it like the rest of them, just to be safe, but I managed to convince you to leave just that one open. I don't think you have any idea how much time I spent in that room on days you were out scavenging for supplies, or skinning a mouse from our trap. Some mornings, I just lay on the floor there, sunbathing. Sometimes, on particularly bright days when the wind was very still, two little gray sparrows would land on the branches of the tree outside that window. I think they might even have been mates. A few weeks ago, even though it was already getting cold, one of them came back with some sticks, and I was so excited that they might be building their nest there that I forgot to do anything I was supposed to do that day, which was quite a bit. I had at least three of your shirts to sew because you kept ripping the seam where the sleeve joined the shoulder, and I was supposed to repair the cardboard covering on one of the first floor windows, where it had peeled loose and was flapping against the cracked glass in the breeze. You were afraid the movement might attract passers-by that otherwise wouldn't have noticed or considered the building. I agreed that this made sense. I just completely forgot. Because the birds... We got in a pretty big fight about that when you got home, I remember. That was before my shadow disappeared and you started handling me with kid gloves. Now, when I forget to do something, you barely say anything at all. Or sometimes even tell me it's fine, that you're just happy I'm still doing well and had a good day. But the look on your face now is so much worse. I'd rather have 100,000 fights than see that look on your face again. Well, I guess I won't have to anymore. Okay, stop being grim. I'm off topic. I remember grabbing a jar of spaghetti sauce mid-count when I first noticed it. The strange stillness in the room. It was always so still when only I was home. But this was stillness of a different quality. It was full of something, rather than absent. I looked down at my shadow there on the floor, and because of the light from that little window, it was perfectly stretched out in front of me. We were the exact same height and shape. There was no distortion from the angle of the sun or a bump in the floor or a wall that might have cut into the silhouette. We matched exactly. Perfectly. Down to the eyelash. I lifted up the jar, and so did my shadow. We both leaned over and set the sauces on the counters, and returned our hands to rest at our sides. It was like I could feel that something was about to happen. Like I shouldn't look away. Then something did. This is going to sound absolutely crazy, but I swear it's true. I was holding perfectly still, under the spell of that feeling, just watching my shadow. It was looking back at me, in the same pose, waiting. Then I saw it tilt its head ever so slightly to the side. All by itself. There was a moment of coldness, like the entire room had dropped 20 degrees. I tried to take a breath, but I couldn't move. Then it was gone. I didn't cry. Not that whole afternoon. Instead, I kept busy, taking inventory of our first aid supplies, cleaning, making sure the window coverings were still secure, double-checking that we had sufficient shotgun ammunition, cleaning and resetting the game trap. I felt like there were so many things to make sure of, and so little time. Like it was all going to end that same night, and I'd just vanish too. Forever. I kept spinning around to look behind me, to see if maybe I'd been mistaken, that the sun had just disappeared behind some clouds for a second, or I simply had cabin fever. But it didn't matter how many times I looked, or how many different directions I shone her spare flashlight on my hand. I couldn't make a silhouette against any surface. In the light on the wall, the plastic cylinder looked like it was floating in midair all by itself, careening wildly about, pointing every which angle. As soon as I noticed, I put it down immediately. I couldn't touch it again. I forgot to start dinner. Instead, I shook out the winter clothes in the storage trunk so they wouldn't have moth holes in them by the time we needed them. I still didn't cry. Even when I went back in the kitchen and saw that jar still sitting on the counter, and its own twin still painted darkly on the floor, I still didn't cry. Not until after it had gotten dark. And I heard your key in the door.
Mana's Amadi. That night, the night the forgetting reached Boston, Nuz had spent the afternoon out on the range with her coach, but every shot was terrible. She bungled them one after another for so many hours that finally he cut the practice short and told her to head home and go to sleep early. Nuz knew something was really off when she didn't argue with him about getting soft on her for once. Her mind just wasn't there. It was like she knew something was coming. "It's in your DNA," her mother would have said. "They say that DNA has a memory, too. That the things that happen to a people are passed down." Nuz would have told her that was nonsense, if they hadn't disowned each other so long ago. When the forgetting hit, after dark, it surprised Nuz that her mother was who she thought of first. Then she thought, "I can't." She'd kept her promise never to speak to her again, since the last time she'd visited Tehran. Her mother had, too. Outside on the street below, she could hear people screaming in the night. Nuz picked up her cell phone. She had started seeing someone recently, maybe seriously. She didn't know. She scrolled to his number, but her finger stalled, hovering over the screen. What did 2.5 months mean, really? 14 dates, 5 lays, 18 glasses of wine, 1 drive to the airport for a weekend trip. He hadn't reached out for Nuz. There was no message flashing, panicked in the blue glow of her screen. It was all right, though. Nuz understood. There were other people who mattered more to them both. The call didn't go through the first time. Nuz was sure everyone who hadn't lost their shadow was busy calling everyone who had. She hung up and immediately dialed again. She was ready to leave a voicemail. "I just wanted to say I'm okay, that's all." Something like that. She was surprised when her mother picked up.
"Are you safe?"
Her mother was sobbing. It was disorienting. To listen as things that used to matter so much evaporated. What filled their empty places to justify all that lost time? Nuz was scrambling for her shoes and wallet. Would a $15,000 charge even go through on her credit card? She couldn't remember how to get to the airport. What freeway? It didn't matter. They'd closed Boston Airport, her mother told her. She'd seen it on the news. Naz couldn't go home.
Are you safe? Tell me you're safe,
her mother pleaded. Naz told her she was okay. Everything was slowly draining out of her. When she'd needed to be brave for someone else a moment ago, it was one thing. But it was hard to be brave for just herself. She backed away from the windows, sank to the carpet. Red and blue alternating flashes passed on the street outside, casting ghostly streaks across the ceiling. I have to get out of the city, Naz thought. At the same moment that her mother was telling her they'd quarantined it, that they were shooting people trying to break the line.
Turn on your damn TV, Manas,
she shouted. The president's face flashed up in front of her, alongside helicopter feeds of various neighborhoods. Naz even saw her own.
What should I do?
She asked her mother.
Should I go upstairs or go in the basement?
No,
her mother cried.
You have to leave the house, now. Anyone could find you there because that's where you're supposed to be.
Boston was a place where her mother's paranoid advice had stopped terrifying Naz long ago. It was a place where no one made two extra turns on the way anywhere to lose a tail, where no one memorized license plates, where no one had a secret hiding place in the hall closet. It was a place where Naz had all the answers, and her mother would flounder embarrassingly on the sidewalk, gaping at the things teenagers carelessly shouted, the crop tops, the virtual reality demos at pop-up game booths on Newbury Street. But this wasn't the Boston Naz knew anymore, and her mother had lived this life before. She had learned a world where one had to know what to do if people were being killed, if someone might be coming to find you. Naz felt herself nodding vigorously at her mother's words.
Where can you go that no one will think to look? Somewhere that wouldn't be worth checking.
That's how Naz ended up living, in her perhaps boyfriend's music studio. She figured, no serious stores of food, no weapons, no camping or survival supplies. A vacant, soundproofed studio inside of a nondescript commercial warehouse was about as unattractive a target as possible. Why would anyone go there to try to wait out the chaos that was happening outside? Naz dumped everything in her pantry, everything in the top drawer of her dresser, her toiletries, and her bow and quiver into a duffel bag.
Do you see anyone? Are you there yet?
Her mother asked in her ear.
Please stop talking,
Naz begged. She'd put the Bluetooth earpiece in her ear and clipped the phone to her belt holster so her mother could stay with her as she sprinted down every side street she could find to reach the studio. The intersection ahead exploded in a hail of bullets. Naz threw herself to the ground, flat against the sidewalk behind a battered parked car. Ahead, a person fell, and someone whooped as if it was a game. More bodies came sprinting down the street, just on the other side of the car. They moved too fast for her to see if they had shadows or not.
Then you talk, she said. Please. A roadblock or a riot, I think,
Naz tried.
Maman, I have to... They'll hear me.
Naz went around. It was the same on the next street. Someone had either shot out the street lamps, or the power grid was starting to fail. All she could see in the glow of the red traffic lights were things running, whipping past each other. Two crashed. A shattering of glass or something. Men screamed.
Police!
The police shouted. Sirens burst to life, and a white car materialized out of the night. The mob attacked the car. Then another mob attacked the mob attacking the car, swinging metal baseball bats.
Fuck!
Naz gasped.
Manas, are you there?
Her mother cried.
Maman, shut up!
Okay, she said more quietly. I have a map, the tourist map you sent me when you first went. The only neighborhood I haven't seen on the internet news yet is Dudley Square. This is on the way to the studio? Can you go through there?
Naz cinched her bag tighter across her chest.
Okay, she said, but no more talking.
Dudley Square was quieter, but in a terrifying way. The lights were all out, even in the houses. Naz could see people in their windows by the light reflecting off their eyes from emergency candles. Her legs were so weak, the muscles burned cold as she tried to move them, but she kept running. She was too afraid to walk. "Please don't shoot me," she thought. "Please see there's still a little dark thing on the sidewalk following me." When she reached the parking lot of the warehouse, there was a single car there, parked in the exact center of the lot. Nuz crouched in the hedges at the edge of the property, staring. Was someone inside, or were they in the building? Would they kill her? Did they have a shadow? The last question sounded so fantastical, so unnatural and horrifying, that she almost giggled hysterically. Her mother waited, breathless. It took Nuz 15 minutes to work up the courage to approach the car, bow drawn. She couldn't tell until she was right up against the driver's window that it was completely burned out, to cinders, with only a skeleton at the wheel. She used her copy of her perhaps boyfriend's key and climbed the stairs to the third floor in pitch blackness.
"Are you there yet?"
"Yes," Nuz panted as she reached the landing. She pushed the door open. Across the gray industrial carpet, she could make out the dim outline of his band's door, their handwritten name still taped to it. She made it. She'd survived the trip. She ducked back into the stairwell and vomited everywhere. Her mother stayed on the phone with Nuz until she fell asleep sometime just before dawn. Her mother knew the boy wasn't there, but Nuz didn't mention him, and she didn't ask more. Nuz was just happy there was someone with her. Well, sort of with her. When she woke up, the phone was dead. She uncurled from the floor behind the huge speakers and tried to sit up. Everything ached. It felt like she'd pulled every muscle in her body the night before trying to run there. Maybe she had. She crawled over to the wall and plugged her charger into the outlet. When the phone came back to life a few minutes later, there were 42 messages. "Are you all right? Can you see the news from where you are? Text me back if you're okay. They're saying on the news that the quarantine is going to continue. Just let me know you're still okay. Call me."
"I'm okay," Nuz said, but gently when she picked up.
Her mother stayed on the line with Nuz again for the rest of the day, and the day after that. She never heard from her perhaps boyfriend. Maybe he'd called his mother too. Maybe he lost his shadow as soon as it hit Boston. It didn't really matter. She never called him either in the end. The day after that, her sister Rojan was on the line as well. Both she and her mother crouched over her mother's mobile phone, placed face up on the kitchen table, shouting slowly and loudly so Nuz could understand them. Nuz broke down sobbing when she first heard Rojan's voice. She'd left Tehran University as soon as she could put all her research on hold and took the first bus to their mother's home.
"What about your studies?"
Nuz had asked her.
"Fuck my studies,"
Rojan said, to which her mother clucked her tongue, but for once didn't admonish her daughter for cursing.
"Just deal with the fact that you need us for once."
Nuz slowly explored the rest of the warehouse to make sure no one else was inside. Her mother ordered her to raid the staff refrigerator on every floor and eat everything in there first, and save her packed non-perishables. For breakfast, Nuz had birthday cake, egg salad, and pickles. Rojan told her to turn on the laptop she found on top of the drum case, but its battery was dead, and the charger was nowhere to be found, so her mother and sister relayed updates to her from the news on their television set instead. Cases had now been spotted in Wyoming, New Hampshire, California, and the D.C. area. Planes had been grounded, interstates closed. Some cities were practically under martial law. Sometimes the three of them didn't say anything at all. They just stayed on the line together. Every 4 hours, Nuz went back to the wall outlet and lay on the floor while her phone was plugged in to charge it back up before the call cut out.
"Where exactly is this studio?"
Rojan kept asking her.
"How do you spell Dorchester Street?"
She became obsessive about it, about being able to pinpoint Nuz's exact location. What does the building look like? How many stories? What shape? What color is the outside? She asked so many questions that their mother finally shouted at her to get her maps and pens out of the way, or she was going to throw them all in the trash, and started knocking what sounded like stacks of paper off the table as they argued.
I know what you're doing. Don't try to come here.
Nuz whispered into the phone to Rojan late that night, after their mother had fallen asleep.
I won't,
Rojan replied.
I mean it. Don't try to find me. It won't help anything. I won't,
Rojan repeated, but Nuz knew she was lying.
Tickets are thousands of dollars anyway. The airport's...
How much? Rojan interrupted.
I don't know, like probably 20 or more thousand to fly in now, because no one wants to come near,
Nuz answered.
Fuck. And Boston Airport is closed and under quarantine, I'm sure.
She finished. She dropped her voice lower.
I'm serious. I can hear people dying out there. It's not safe. Don't come.
She tried to think of something she could say that would force her sister to listen.
Stay with Maman. Don't leave her alone. Don't make it so that she has two daughters here instead of just one. Okay?
Rojan made a small sound like Nuz had physically hurt her.
So what, you're just going to be alone over there trying to survive without any help? What would you coming do anyway?
Nuz asked.
I don't know, but something, anything, she said. You're my sister, Manas. Don't come, Rojan,
Nuz warned.
Don't leave Maman.
She could hear Rojan breathing slowly on the other end of the line. It sounded like she was trying not to cry.
Okay, I won't come,
she finally said.
Promise,
Nuz ordered.
I promise.
Nuz settled back against the wall and cradled the phone between her ear and shoulder. She still didn't know if she fully believed her sister, but she also knew that if Rojan was still lying, arguing about it further wouldn't convince her. All it would do was wake their mother up when one of them started shouting.
Can you see the stars?
Rojan asked in the silence.
From the roof,
Nuz said.
Go up there.
The day after, Nuz woke up to light rain pattering against the windows. I should try to collect that for drinking, she thought groggily, as she rolled over on the carpet to unplug her phone from the wall. But the charge was barely full. Nuz called and her mother picked up crying. She and Rojan already knew from the news that the power had gone out in Boston overnight.
How much battery do you have left?
Is all she said.
7%,
Nuz answered. Nuz left the earpiece in for weeks, even though it was useless. She knew even then that it seemed a little crazy, but she kept talking to them as if they were there. She needed to.
Whew, that was heavy,
she'd say when she finished lugging down water from containers she'd found around the building and put open-faced on the roof. Or,
remember when we found out I'd been accepted to train here?
Or,
did you hear that?
When an errant sound had terrified her in the middle of the night. It turned out to be a rat in the ventilation system, not a human. Nuz asked Rojan which office she should move to when the music studio grew boring and small, then babbled about the pros and cons. She described what other floors looked like. She asked her mother if they'd both known what would happen. Would she still have cut Nuz off to try to stop her from dating? If the shadowlessness had never come, would she have held out until she died? Or given up and reached out? She asked if she might try to be better to Rojan than she had been to Nuz, if Rojan wanted something else someday too. Slowly, slowly, Nuz stopped talking. Orlando Jong. As soon as it was light enough to see, Ori sprinted. out of the shelter, down the mountain, all the way to the first ruin of road. That's where he stopped, jerked to a halt at the edge of that asphalt path. He had no idea which way Max had gone. The sun was out, burning so bright everything was white instead of yellow. It made the blow to the back of his head from the night before throb painfully. East, toward downtown Arlington and then D.C., past the river, was slightly more traversable. West, toward Fairfax County, and all the western cities like Falls Church and Oakton and Centerville, was overgrown and wild. Ori gritted through the headache, studying the ground for tracks, but there weren't any. There was too much grass and rock, and not enough dust to see any footprints Max might have left. How much of her memory had she lost exactly? Even if it had been a devastating amount, there had to be some figment of it left that would have made her choose one path over the other. A spray of birds shot across the sky from one tree to another, screeching, then disappeared into the leaves. But what if whatever remained wasn't a part he knew? The birds chattered again, and then fell silent. Every second that went by was a day. How far could a person who didn't know where they were going get? No explanation, no clues, no map. She had vanished without a single trace, as silently and mysteriously as had her shadow. Where did the shadows go? Ori wondered. He didn't even care about the why anymore. Only the where. The why was inexplicable. Ori didn't believe in magic, but he knew in his heart that what had happened was nothing that could be understood by humans. It was no natural disaster, no disease, no biological weapon. The best name he'd ever heard for it was curse. Because in the end it didn't matter who you were. No one escaped, either because they were someone who lost their shadow, or because they were someone who loved someone who lost their shadow. Ori gritted his teeth. It was impossible to hope now, but he had to believe that the person he was chasing was still Max. Otherwise, what would be the point of trying to find her? And if he was chasing Max, then there was only one direction she would have chosen. She'd try to go home. Not the shelter, but their real home. The apartment where they'd lived in D.C. before the forgetting. Before they'd gotten in the car that weekend so long ago to drive into Virginia for Paul and Emmanuel's wedding. Before everything. Ori held his breath and ran east, straight into the low-hanging morning light, as if he could outrun his terror. If he could just make it far enough, the rising sun would turn into a bridge, and then he'd be in D.C., and Max would have to be there. She'd have to be. That's what he told himself until he couldn't run anymore. Audric's corner had turned into a willow forest, curtains of leaves everywhere. For some reason, the sidewalks had been refashioned into spirals. Ori rested only long enough for the sweat to dry across his forehead. He went on with the gun out then. Since Paul and Emmanuel's wedding, neither he or Max had returned to their apartment. She had wanted fiercely to go back, but it was too dangerous. Before the news went down, they'd seen the scenes from Boston, San Francisco, D.C. Fires, looting, roving gangs. There was plenty of food at Elk Cliffs Resort from the wedding, and the slope of the mountain provided natural protection. Over the years, as more and more of the other guests disappeared, or left to try to make it to their own homes, Ori became convinced that only their mountain was safe. Who knew what was lurking there in the east, in the great silent black hole that had been their capital? For a moment, he remembered the strange group he'd met on Broad Street, what their leader Ursula had said. Bad things. Bad things are happening in D.C. There was a rustling in the hedges alongside Old Cedar Road. Ori didn't like it there, in that part of Arlington. Houses lined both sides of the street, set far back with low-hanging trees. No one was inside, but the shades behind the windows blinked languidly on their own from time to time, like drowsy eyelids. On the side of one garage, someone had scrawled in charcoal, "The Dreamless One," and "The One Who Gathers." There was more movement, a nervous shuffling. Ori looked and saw no dark shape there under the trembling leaves. He raised the gun and ran. He crossed under the I-495 in late evening. Would Max have made it as far east as McLean in one day? Perhaps, but no farther. Ori had scoured the ground for signs of her as he went. A dropped supply he might recognize from their stash, a tear of familiar clothing, even a footprint. But had found nothing. Nothing from anyone at all, even. There was a shoe that had been in the gutter so long it was fossilized in mud. A ways after, there had been a bone, but it was old. So old he did not have to look away as he passed it. In the night, Ori heard something inhumanly heavy cross the interstate, walking over the top of the overpass instead of below. He huddled closer to the dank concrete wall as it passed. Even with the moon, it was so pitch black, he could not have seen if there was a shadow or not. He didn't try to look. He held the wall and prayed the sound above would move on. In the morning, he climbed onto the overpass to see what might have been there. But there were only wildflowers and a single car tire.
The morning after the Boston emergency broadcast, I opened my eyes to the worst hangover I've ever had. Dim flashes of the night before returned. Marion, my best friend from high school, who'd become almost as close to Emmanuel as she and I were to each other, calling for calm. J. Rhino White. Someone's plus one. Although we never quite figured out whose, declaring himself captain of an investigative scouting team he'd just created. Paul, saying, "Fuck this, I'm getting the champagne," and going to get it. All of it. "If this is the last day on Earth, we can't waste a drop." Do you remember that? I had to agree with him. It all became a blur after the eighth glass. At some point during the night, I'd managed to get myself to our guest suite, pull the blankets and pillows off our bed, bring them back downstairs into the ballroom, and pick us out a spot on the east edge, in the corner where the wood wall met the glass one. I woke up with my face buried in your tuxedoed shoulder, which smelled of Bollinger, candle smoke, and cinnamon, somehow. The light through the trees was so clear it was blinding. Sharp, piercing beams cut through the branches and seared white shapes into the dark grass. The news was still on TV in the corner, the volume lowered so that only the people clustered beneath it could hear, to allow the rest of us to sleep. I tried to blink the world back into focus. Capitol Hill was on the screen, and then the Golden Gate Bridge replaced it, some kind of ticker running below. "Ori," I nudged your arm. "Wake up." You sat up slowly, but by the time you were fully upright, you looked alert. What happened?
Where else?" you asked.
We both turned back to the TV.
"You're awake," Rhino said when he saw us sitting.
I noticed Paul, Emmanuel, and Marion already standing awkwardly next to him, as if ordered to be there.
"Volunteer?"
he asked hopefully. That was how we became the first scouting party for the Elk Cliffs Resort survivors.
"Therefore the occasional bear or wolf that wanders too close to the grounds," the resort maitre d', Gabe, said as he unlocked the staff-only closet. He brought out two shotguns and one hunting rifle.
"Not even occasional. Very rare. Very rare."
He corrected himself on instinct, still thinking of us as luxury guests. Maybe we all still did as well.
"How many bullets do we have?"
Rhino asked.
"Enough for an exploratory trip down the mountain," Gabe replied.
"Enough for hunting when we run out of food?"
"That's getting a little ahead of ourselves,"
Ori said. Rhino shrugged. Is it, though? What will the rest of us use? I interrupted. There are six of us. You, Rhino, Paul, Emmanuel, Marion, and me. And only three guns. Well, I can actually shoot, Marion said. The others all looked at her. I grew up on a ranch in Texas. A little cattle ranch. What?
Okay, one for Marion, one for me, Rhino said. Emmanuel?
Give it to Ori, Emmanuel offered politely.
Give it to Max,
Paul overrode him. You rubbed the back of your head, cheeks reddening. It was not the right time to smile. Paul and I tried not to, without much success.
This isn't soccer, you protested weakly.
Exactly, Paul said. It's worse. Definitely give it to Max.
What is the matter with you? Emmanuel whispered sharply to Paul. Paul finally choked, and the giggles escaped him in a strangled gasp. You had been the only kid in their high school to ever score a goal for the opposite team. Twice, I finally explained to the rest of them as Paul collapsed into a fit of laughter. We climbed down the mountain in silence, walking just next to the paved road that led up to the picturesque resort from Elk Cliffs Road. You, Paul, and Emmanuel carried huge backpacks instead of weapons.
Odric's Corner, Rhino said to us as we marched. That's the first neighborhood we'll hit.
The trees opened up ahead. I braced for the eerie, deserted silence of Boston we'd seen on the news after all the shooting stopped. But Odric's Corner was chaos. Cars blaring at each other, women herding families back and forth across streets, people biking with mountains of belongings strapped to their backs, men defending laden shopping carts and parking lots with their lives. Food, Marion said when she spotted a grocery store. It all dawned on us then. How much food did we have at Elk Cliffs Resort? Emmanuel had booked caterers for the ceremony and reception, but how long would those leftovers last? How much was in their deep freezers for regular guests? How long would deep freezers last if the power went out? Would the power go out? Rhino stayed outside with the guns, asking passersby for information. The rest of us went inside the shop and pulled everything we could find off the shelves. You, Paul, and Emmanuel tried to look large and intimidating as Marion and I snatched whatever was left. Single shoppers approached, eyed the five of us, then slunk away for other aisles. Grab the rice, Marion hissed at me as we wheeled ourselves into the never-ending line to pay. I grabbed as many as I could. In a strange way, it reminded me almost of something she and I might have done in university with our friends, while too drunk. Run to the campus food store just before it closed and play various games. Who could fit inside the plastic shopping cart seat like a kid again? Who could swipe an entire shelf into the basket at once without dropping a single item? Who could finish their list first and race to the checkout line before the other teams? But no one was laughing this time.
Please, I have children, a woman behind us said. We turned around. Her cart was a third as full as ours, with food half as useful. The shelves were almost bare by then. I have children, she repeated. I wanted to crumble inside.
We have children, too. Marion lied before any of us could answer. She knew me too well. She stepped in front of us, between me and the woman, so I had no choice but to set the rice back down into our own cart.
Please, the woman said again, but weaker this time. No, it's all right.
Has it reached Arlington yet?
Paul asked her gently.
We're on vacation. With our kids. We only just found out.
I don't know, she said. But I think Maryland, at least. I saw something like that on the news. That's when I came here. My sons are still at home.
It's in D.C.,
the man in line ahead of us said. He held up his phone,
They caught a guy downtown near the Verizon Center this morning.
The woman moaned. She sank lower over her cart.
How are we going to pay for this? I suddenly whispered to you. I didn't bring my purse.
It was probably a month's worth of food, and all I had were a handful of crumpled bills in my jeans pocket from the day before, from when you had to pay a toll fee on the highway into Virginia from D.C. to reach Elk Cliffs.
Put it on my card, Emmanuel said. Wedding expenses.
Oh, God! The woman behind us said suddenly. We turned to look at her. She was holding her wallet as if it was white-hot porcelain, searing her fingers, but too precious to drop.
Oh, God!
We all looked inside. The dark green ink on the bills had somehow vanished. The papers were completely blank.
What the fuck? Marion said in horror. What is that? My children!
The woman wailed.
I have to feed my children!
I'll pay for it, I gasped. I was crying, terrified. I tried to shove whatever bills were in my pocket at her, desperately pressing them against her chest. Far at the front of the line, a fight broke out. People began to yell. Then we all realized that my money had become the same impossible blank things as well. 3 days after that, reports said that almost everyone in D.C. was now shadowless. We sat in circles around the main ballroom TV, cutting marshmallows into tiny pieces and eating them slowly to make them last. The brand on the front of the bags was a name I couldn't read. The letters looked like they had once spelled something, but didn't quite look like letters anymore. Rhino suggested we start trying to hunt game for food in the forest around the resort with the guns. Philadelphia, Baltimore, then Arlington. After that, Elk Cliffs Resort lost power, because we were on the Arlington grid. The day after there was no more electricity, Rhino and Marion returned from the far side of the mountain, stumbling under the weight of a small elk. The wedding band made a fire in the fancy stone pit in the courtyard using the strange empty dollar bills as kindling. We burned it all. Not a single person kept even one piece. We wanted it gone. They roasted the elk while you, me, and a couple of other guests from Paul's side went through what was left in the kitchen and separated it into eat tonight before it goes off, eat within the next few days, and save as long as we can. The singer didn't want to sing that night. Or anymore. The rest of the band played something instrumental, and we all feasted on elk steak, shrimp, random fillets of fish, and a metric fuckton of ice cream. Tomorrow was going to be a lot worse than today, I realized dimly as I sat in front of the fire, digging around in my own personal gallon of mint chocolate chip. There was so much that every single guest got their own container. And the day after tomorrow was going to be a lot worse than tomorrow. Today was probably the last good day. After I finished that ice cream and crawled under our blankets with you and fell asleep, it was never going to go back up again. Only down. Want some Rocky Road? You asked. And we swapped. The chocolate fudge was so gooey and sweet that it made the glands at the back of my jaw pinch painfully. That was probably never going to happen again either. A kind of sweetness so artificially strong that it could make my mouth ache. Suddenly I was crying again, before I even knew what was happening. I have to pee, I said hurriedly, and scrambled away from the fire before anyone else realized my eyes were swollen and red. I don't think you saw. I stopped as soon as I left the manicured part of the hill and hit the trees, and found myself gulping desperately as I pressed the heels of my hands into my eyes. I should have savored it more, I thought. I should have fought violently for my favorite flavor. Then I realized someone else was already out here, probably doing the same thing in the trees.
The ice cream? Marion asked through the darkness. I nodded. I tried to clear my throat. It was so fucking good.
Marion snorted gently in agreement. I could tell she dug the toe of her shoe into the dirt only by the sound of it grinding.
It's the phones for me, she murmured. Fuck, I said. Her husband and daughter were still in San Diego. He'd had to skip the wedding to take care of their little girl who got the flu. Fuck, Marion. I felt sick for having forgotten, in all the chaos. When are you going to...
Don't, Marion said. I can't think of it directly. Not yet.
I wanted to go to her. To hug her like we always did when one of us had just argued with a boyfriend or done poorly on an exam. But I didn't know how to.
We stood there for a while, pushing rocks around with our feet instead, not saying anything. There was no more ice cream. There was no more of a lot of things.
But there was still you. Ori, here with me. That was something. That was more than hope.
Marion's outline, barely visible in the night, was leaning against a tree, holding some kind of leaf. It was so dark I realized I couldn't tell if either of us still had shadows anymore.
I think that was the first time it occurred to me to wonder,
and the last time I could ever have that thought without compulsively checking to make sure my own was still there. Of being able to do nothing else, not even breathe, until I saw that it was still a part of me.
What do you think? Marion spoke suddenly. What do you think caused this?
I don't know, I said. It was true. I didn't.
Not for sure.
She laughed. It didn't sound much like a laugh. Rob and I separated, she finally said.
All the air went out of me.
2 weeks ago. Hallie doesn't have the flu. I was going to tell you at the reception, once we were drunk enough. But then Boston happened.
Marion.
I know it's not karma, she interrupted, cutting me off. That would be stupid.
But I just can't help it. She took a shaky breath. You and Ori, Paul and Emmanuel, happy. Here we all are at the end of the world, and you guys are here together. I'm the only one with marriage troubles. And look where I am, where he is.
It's not karma, I said desperately. Karma doesn't exist.
I know, Marion replied. But it sure seems like it, doesn't it? I didn't know what to say. But it didn't matter. I knew what she wanted me to know. That if she'd known somehow that it really was going to end now. Not in some far future time, but now. Right now. She never would have left him. She would have cherished all the moments. We waited in silence for what felt like hours. I'm going back now, I finally said. I couldn't think of anything to comfort her. There was nothing to say, without looking at the truth of it head on. No way to offer hope without also reminding her that she might never see them again. I'm going to stay, Marion answered. When I reemerged from the woods and sat down beside you again at the fire, Rhino was standing, stating to the group that he was going to drag his blankets out onto the grass after we put the fire out, because now that there was no electricity and therefore no air conditioning, it was going to be disgustingly hot in the ballroom where we were all camped out. He wasn't really announcing it, I knew as I watched him. It was more that he was trying to ask the rest of us to join him without begging outright. For comfort in numbers.
I realized that none of us had even tried sleeping in our individual guest rooms once. After the wedding reception had been interrupted by the news about Boston, we'd all banded together in the ballroom and never left, safe to retrieve our suitcases and bring them back down. The courtyard where Rhino wanted to sleep was a couple hundred feet from where the rest of us were still set up inside. 9 days ago, that wouldn't have been enough distance for me to be from a random stranger. Now it felt terrifyingly far.
"That's a good idea," you said. "Let's all move out here."
Over the top of the flames, Rhino looked at you so gratefully it made my eyes tear again.
Mana's Amadi. The night Nuz considered killing herself, she saw her sister again. It was a few weeks after she finally took the Bluetooth headset off. She wasn't sure of the exact date, but it was snowing outside, which meant she'd been in the studio for 4 or 5 months by then, hiding, talking to herself, and beginning to starve. She'd rationed well, but there was no food left in the entire building anymore, or in the duffel bag. She'd gone out a few times to the roof, but all she could see beyond the vast, empty parking lot was darkness and the glow of flashing police lights, and all she could hear were the echoing sounds of people crying or being killed. She had her bow, but it was no good in situations like that. In the open or one-on-one, she might win, but against a crowd, in a city, a bow was almost useless. In close quarters, she'd never stop every single one of a gang before one of them reached her and took her down. She planned to jump, or at least think about jumping soon, before the hunger made her too weak to find a quicker, more dignified death than starvation. Her mother had almost starved once, she'd told her, when the times were very bad. It was a way of leaving life that Nuz never wanted to experience. But that night, there was a small, solitary shape standing uncertainly in the center of the parking lot. A woman. The sight didn't frighten Nuz. She assumed the woman was just a ghost. Nuz had seen the apparitions of her sister so many times after the phone cut off. In the hall, across the room, sleeping beside her. Why not also lurking amongst the empty car spaces, looking up at her? She was about to ask it to point out some constellations for old time's sake. But then she saw that the ghost had a shadow.
Manas?
It called softly. Nuz was down every flight of stairs and out the front door before she even realized it.
Rojan!
She was screaming. Rojan had run for the entrance too, and had been pulling on the front door before Nuz had made it to the ground floor and flipped the lock. They tumbled backward into the dark warehouse in a tangle of limbs, and then clambered to slam the door shut behind them and do up the locks again.
You promised! You promised!
Nuz kept wailing over and over.
You promised you wouldn't do this! You promised you wouldn't come!
Rojan was clinging to her so hard she could feel her skin going numb and bloodless on the parts of her arms where Rojan held them. They kissed each other's cheeks until they had smeared the tears all over their faces, until all she could taste or see or breathe was stinging salt.
"Thank God you're here,"
Rojan sniffed and kissed her again.
"I was so scared. I thought I'd finally make it here and you already would have left or something." You.
Nuz could barely speak between the heaving sobs. The miraculousness of it was finally starting to pierce the anger.
You're really here. I'm sorry,
she said.
I know I said I...
She reached down and pulled a wad of paper out of her pockets. Handfuls of notes she'd made, neighborhood maps she'd tried to draw, descriptions of the building she was looking for, everything she'd written down from their phone conversations.
I just couldn't let you be alone. But how did you get all the way here from Tehran?
Nuz interrupted.
How did you get out of the house without Maman freaking out? What do you mean, Maman freaking out?
Rojan shook her head.
She's the only reason I did make it here. You think I just had thousands and thousands of U.S. dollars lying around in my student dormitory room for a plane ticket?
Nuz stared at her. But she couldn't finish.
The day after your phone died, she gave me everything she had, emptied out her accounts. She told me to find you.
Nuz was shaking.
She helped you come here?
She ran her hands up and down Rojan's arms over and over, as if each time she did it, she might discover